John run over. In the beginning of the visit with Russell Nobles and Debbie. This Thursday supper is the 23rd of January, 75. John run over. Beginning the visit with Russell Nobles and Debbie. This Thursday, 23rd of January, 75. Channel run over. And beginning the visit with Russell Nobles and Debbie. This Thursday, 23rd of January, 75.
Yes, I do. At night.
At night, yeah. It rained every day.
I remember that, yeah.
And it was about this temperature.
I was thinking, for some reason, I was thinking that it was hot, and that's why we moved out of that horrible hotel, because it didn't have a bathroom.
No, it wasn't hot. It was hot the first day we got to Paris.
That's when we moved.
Now, that's when we got into it. But it was really very cold. It was 60.
Cold.
Well, remember? Yeah.
I don't remember it being that cold. That place I remember being cold is England, but I remember it being cold in Corsica on the beach.
Oh, I remember that too. Mm-hmm. I remember crawling up under a boat because it was raining.
And trying to get flat on the sand because the wind was so cold.
Well, I can also remember walking down there and not knowing how to get back. Oh.
That was way down the hill?
2.5 miles down the hill. Down the mountain. Not down the hill, down the mountain.
Didn't you run into somebody down there to ferry you up and down?
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth.
Yeah, but until we ran into them, we said we didn't know if we were going to... Mm-hmm.
We managed to every time, too. It was different people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we met that one couple that had the kayak, and they took us out in the kayak the next day.
Yeah.
But then one time we just hitchhiked and rode back up with
two people who lived around there.
Lived down there, yeah.
Well, I thought you rode the bus down.
There wasn't a bus.
This is just a little tiny town, 20 houses made out of stone. There's hardly any cars.
How far down?
2.5 miles down.
What you said?
Hairpin turn. So it wasn't just like, 2.5 miles was probably if you just measured down the hill.
Probably.
But we were going like this, stopping on every hairpin to take a picture.
So you had to hitchhike.
Going up back up, we walked all the way down. But
the
going back
step,
up, we hitchhiked.
Didn't do that the second time.
So I guess we didn't. I guess we the people in the kayak.
I don't think we could
have.
Yeah, you don't care too much to take it, do you?
That's fine. Oh, thank you. That looks good.
Okay. Now, who would you want me as the buttermilk? You?
I
what about you? No buttermilk?
No buttermilk, no.
Okay. Have some coffee.
Y'all, go ahead and start.
Oh, okay.
And I'll get guys
out. I'll give you just a little light. So you can tell what it's potatoes.
Tell what it is. Oh, it's turnip greens. Oh, they smell good.
Oh.
Fresh out of his garden? Mm.
Yeah,
we'll
just pick them.
Oh, how wonderful.
Oh, they're wonderful.
John Turner really feels sorry for himself. He had the flu, and furthermore, it keeps coming back on him.
Mm.
If not the flu, at least a bad throat or croup.
Mm.
He calls up, and you can tell who it is on the phone.
Who's the one that's going to plant peanuts?
Yeah.
On your pasture over there?
Yeah. She's no more. It's a little weak. You know JR?
Mm-hmm.
I'll show you a picture, huh? I'll take you.
JR?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good.
That's a terrific picture. Mm-hmm.
Y'all would just love him. I know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a wonderful picture. Who took that? You see it?
Yeah, that's really good.
On a cloudy day, it doesn't matter anymore.
No. Doesn't matter at all. It looks good, as a matter of fact, because it makes the background
fuzzy.
Fuzzy. Uh-huh. It helps.
Yeah. Have one of those things.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's out of the garden too?
See, I really had a row of them. They're thick and they are big. He didn't have any small ones like this. I was just over there. We went by this morning.
Yeah, he's got your tractor, I said. That's it. In the picture.
He's moving dirt somehow. He's got a grader.
It's a little Ford?
He's got a bucket behind it. Grader. Blade.
Oh.
That he borrowed. Of course, Dale, I can borrow anything. He wouldn't even bring it to him, you know. I couldn't borrow it if I went and got it.
All he has to do is call up and say he needs it.
People bring it over?
Yeah, they'll even ask him if he needs it.
Have half cornbread.
Oh, thank you. I will. Oops.
Ah. Yeah, it is. Oops. Only thing I got in the days is some oil,
you.
But I didn't get myself any. Yeah.
Oh, that's fine. That's good.
Well now, Russell, you have a good influence on Debbie. She looks like she's just as fresh as a violet.
She does have a good influence on me.
I try.
She fusses at me and tells me.
She does what?
Tells me how to do things. She's good to have around.
For short stretches. You don't want somebody fussing at you all the time. Of course, if I were around, I wouldn't fuss all the time. I hope.
Well, now you were up at the office yesterday afternoon?
Mm-hmm.
All afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I get you some coffee.
Hmm.
Well, that's a nice place up there.
Rugs on the floor. Windows open.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You really have windows?
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful people coming in.
Marvelous. Fascinating. Dean of the graduate school came in to complain because his name in the catalog wasn't followed by his title. Although he did have a nice picture.
Kurt didn't say Dean of the graduate school. So he made, we had to type up this little thing that said, due to an editorial error, he was not identified as dean of the graduate school. And we had to sit there and put him in the, I didn't, but the people in the next office had to sit there and put this little piece of paper in the brochure.
He noticed it.
The first thing he noticed, he opened it and saw it. I don't know how this could have escaped me before. I wish it hadn't escaped him before.
When he came in, though, he was so concerned and he was so upset about it. I had no idea what horrible mistake could have been made.
Well, he got to keep up the prestige of his office.
I suppose so.
He does.
I suppose so. I suppose if you let these, let your standards slip, the whole thing would just
well,
crash.
A lot of it is, see, if he doesn't keep reminding people who they are, who he is, they'll forget. So
that'd be terrible, wouldn't it?
For him it would be, yeah.
Hey, you're not going to be in on it if you don't hurry.
Well, if
It's my great pleasure to see everybody else leading the way. There you are. Ben Craig.
Oh, we got to take you too.
Good. I haven't had turnip greens in a long time.
These are really good.
Fresh. They couldn't be fresher.
When did you pick them? 5:30?
No, I guess we got back up. Well, I took Russell home and came on back, and we went right down and picked them. I think they need washing.
Right out of the garden.
These are turnip greens and mustard and rutabaga tops all mixed up.
Oh, good. Well, one thing they're doing at down there at the university is turning off all the lights. It's dark all the time everywhere. They're trying to save money because the university is $1.5 million in the hole, something like that. And the editorial in the paper, the Alligator today, said that what they thought they should do is that all the career service employees should work one day a week for free and donate the money to the university. And that would get us out of the hole really fast. I said, no way.
Well, one thing that seems like to me they shouldn't do is quit buying books for the library. But
isn't that amazing? They need to cut the budget so they no longer have acquisitions for the library and they no longer bind in the library.
Oh,
that's terror. Want to cut the budget? Cut it at the library. I have a friend who works in the library. She binds the book. She binds the dissertation. And she called me up at 4 minutes after 8 o'clock this morning. 4 minutes after 8, my phone was ringing and I picked it up and I said hello. And she just giggles when she gets on the phone. She talks like a foghorn, just like this. And I talked to her on the phone for a good 6 months before I met her, and I thought she was going to be, you know, some really big woman, just, you know, like Little Bessie or something because of her voice. Well, she's tiny. She's like this, and she opens her mouth, and this enormous voice comes out, and you just don't know where it comes from. Little tiny person. Dot, her name is, and Dot called this morning. She was supposed to come get the dissertations today, and she said, well, it's raining outside. I'm not coming. She said, none of us have anything to do over here anyway. I better save some work for next week. You know they're not buying any more books for this library. They're not binding any more books for this library. We might as well just all close up the university and go home. There's just no point in having a library if they're not going to buy any books for it. She said, I think I just was born in another century or something. I mean, what kind of university is it that doesn't buy books for its library? None of us have anything to do over here, she said.
Even hard times, they still have to buy a book or two.
Nope. What did you say? Isn't that just... And she said, and the thing I can't understand is nobody has complained about it. And it's true, nobody has said a word.
Let me tell you, Debbie, there's so much to complain about, you just can't get around.
I guess so.
You start to write your congressman about something, and before you can write your letter, you've got 16 other things on your mind.
Have some time. Right over here.
Okay.
Not cut very well. That's strange.
Well?
That's it.
I want you all to get on to this subject that we were talking about. I want to know about that Gladys girl.
Russell's eye is fresher than mine. I've been moldering away there for you now.
It's the right word.
Oh,
I just think it's a bad place. I mean it. There's no vitality in it. There's people running around.
Well, keeping records is always sort of deadly. And that's essentially what they do.
Well, it's not your job, though. Is it? Or is it?
A lot of my job is.
Keeping records.
Mm-hmm.
Of the PhD theses that have passed through your hands? So?
Mm-hmm.
And they all do?
They all do. Uh-huh.
Is that strong enough?
Thank you, I'm sure.
Where do you want that?
But it seems like also a lot of what you do is get on the phone and tell people things,
mm-hmm.
or answer questions, like when they have to have their dissertation in,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how wide to space the margins,
and whether or not they should go ahead and finish the word or put the syllable on the next line, because that'll go over the inch margin, and they're really afraid that if it's over the inch margin, we will know about it immediately on page 96 of a 300-page dissertation. We'll see that, and we'll tell them that they have to send the dissertation back.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh.
They get very anxious. I don't know. Writing a dissertation turns everyone into, makes them very nervous.
But that's a matter of common sense.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. It's not, because by the time they get to writing their dissertation, they have been in the university for so many years that they know that if they infringe on any rule, they're going to get nailed.
Mm.
And they're afraid even to infringe on that rule. It's true. It's sad, but it's true.
Doesn't sound like the university is a terribly good place to be, does it?
No.
Especially the graduate school. What would you say, Debbie? What does it do to a person? All that.
Well. It usually just makes me feel sort of numb. Really, by the end of the day, I'm always extremely tired. Very, very tired. I'm just like I've been running 100 miles. And I'm numb. And I can't wait to get out. And
after you get out?
I'm numb for a while. And it depends on what I'm doing. I can revive again very quickly. I'm not really that tired. I'm just dazed. And I always think, well, a lot of times I go to work and I think, well, now I have an hour, it's mine, and I have various other times during the day when I can do things, and I always think I'll do things, you know, like I'll do such and such a thing at noon, and somehow I never seem to get anything done during the day because I'm just, like I walk in the door and somebody hits me with the end of a screwdriver, whomp, right on the head, and that's it. It was a totally different environment when I worked in Boston. it was a different environment in the office. And, you know, we fussed about going to work. We said we didn't like to get up and go to work every day, but on the whole, we had a good time. And we didn't hate to spend time there, and we didn't hate what we did. Although it was routine. After a while, you were doing the same thing, and it was routine. But he wrote different articles every month. You didn't weren't writing the same article over and over again.
You know what impressed me about your office, though, over there? It's so quiet. It's so dignified and proper and restrained. I never worked.
I couldn't
in an
believe when
like
I started
that.
Working there. I couldn't believe that they really expected you to be there at 8 o'clock, and they really expected you to stay until 5. And if you went to lunch at 12, they expected you to be back at 1. I never experienced that in my life. When we went to lunch at Tufts, we went to lunch. We stayed 2 hours. And if we wanted to leave and go home because somebody was coming to eat supper with us, well, we'd leave at 3 o'clock and go home and fix supper. I can remember many times stopping in Max Elder's office and saying, "Oh, Mr. Elder, I have to fix shrimp Creole tonight. I'll see you tomorrow." Go out the door. And he'd say, "Oh, well, yeah, shrimp Creole," and go back to what he was doing, and I'd go. Nobody, you know, they knew that eventually we would get done what needed to be done, and if we needed to leave, we left.
I called over one time, it was right on the dot, 5 o'clock, and Debbie said she was tempted to walk out and let it ring, but she didn't. She picked it up.
Oh.
And I told her, she made a mistake.
There's your dessert. You're awesome.
Mm.
Thank you. Yeah, she should have just walked out.
I've tried telling them at the front desk that I don't accept calls before 8:30 or after 4:30, but they don't seem to take it seriously.
You should do what I did after a while at Harper's. One time a friend of mine who had called me up several times straight for something that was not business said to me, "You know what you sound like when you answer the telephone?" I said, "No." He said, "You sound like, hello?" in a tone of voice that means, "So what do you want already?" And it really keeps people in line. It's not nice, but...
they don't call you back.
Well, not for things that don't matter.
Mm.
You know, if I had said yes, no, to everybody who called, and some of them were just frivolous calls, not just from friends, but from people I had to deal with that were unnecessary.
Well, you've also got this burdensome subject matter on your mind a good part of the time. And you can't read through those things without getting a little of it on your mind.
No. And it's... Dave, when you do 2 or 3 a day, that's when I feel like... well, at the end of the quarter, there's usually a month when I work 7 days a week reading these things.
You go in on Saturday or Sunday?
I have to. They have to have them back.
She's not
going to
get over them.
They do not have to have them
back. They do. They have to take them to their exam and defend them.
Well, they should get them in earlier.
They get them in by the deadline. We just get 100 of them.
I see Russell.
Do they pay you time and a half for that?
Yeah, they pay me for it.
I should hope so. But you shouldn't have to do that. That's horrible.
In August, it was horrible.
Saturday, all day Saturday and Sunday?
Well, in the summer, it was that much. This fall, I didn't have to do it that much. I worked a couple weekends.
It's funny. I worked every Saturday and Sunday the whole semester, but that's different. I was in horror when I had a job. I didn't work all the time.
You didn't?
No. They wouldn't have asked me, I don't think. It was a job that had definite limits, and nobody ever expected me to do overtime work. Once, when I was at Holt, I took a project home because it was very, very important. But everyone was so appalled that I never did it again.
This, tell him I'm going back. I can't see quite where it leads.
I can't quite see where it leads either. I don't think it does lead anywhere, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Because you're not getting technical enough experience, it seems like, to take it into a commercial publisher.
Probably not, no, because they don't prepare anything for a printer.
I didn't quite get that. The just the kind of work you do up there, I can't see where it would lead.
It doesn't lead anywhere.
Well, now you can stay there. You see, if you are clerk typist third class, you can stay there a little while, and you'd be clerk typist second class, whichever way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
If you call that leading somewhere. After all, I can see. After somebody wants to go home and put up some more stuff for the refrigerator.
That's sort of what I said to you yesterday. That if you did quit that job, you could find another job as good as that. And that's not the last job in the world. Probably couldn't find one in Gainesville, though.
I know I couldn't find one in Gainesville.
Now, this is something that I run into, and I put in just enough time on it to see what the problem is, and not enough to do anything about it. It's easy enough to find a printer, but there are no editors. There's nobody who can prepare it for the printer. Now, I'm not talking about working on the manuscript. I can do that. I'm talking about preparing it for the printer.
I mean, type mark it and do things like that?
Yeah.
And that's what I learned to do in my first job.
Yeah.
To key mark, to type mark, to direct the printer how to do things
yeah.
in a way that the printer understands
yeah.
and in a way that he can follow without making a mess of everything.
Yeah. And you also make the decisions as it's a matter of taste as well as knowledge.
Style. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually what we did was the art department would decide on type. And they would bring us the samples. And we would go over that and see what mistakes. I worked for a woman who knew this stuff so well that she could correct the art department. Oh, they've got two spaces wrong here. And I picked some of that up. I've forgotten a lot of it, but I could go back and pick it up, I'm sure. And she taught me how to instruct the compositor, the printer, which is very important because you have to tell them, if you want to tell them to move something, there are better ways to tell them to move this paragraph on page 8 to page 9 than they're, you know, not saying it very right. There's a way to tell him that's very easy for him to understand, and there are ways that are very hard for him to understand.
And he just clips it off, and he don't want to think.
Mm-mm. No, and that's what you have to do. You have to prepare it so that he doesn't have to think. You say, printer, transfer this paragraph to page 9 where indicated.
Yeah.
And you draw a circle around the paragraph, and then on page 9, you put an arrow in where you want it. Where you want the paragraph to go, and you say printer. Insert paragraph from page 8 here. That way he can't. So.
That seems pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen people draw lines all over pages, and it does. It sounds remarkably simple. Yeah. I always thought that was the most valuable thing I ever learned from
her. Well, that's the that's a part of it. Now, that's not simply typography, you might say. It's also some understanding of the script of the manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't find anyone like that
outside of commercial publishers.
Yeah.
There might be somebody in university presses.
Yeah, but that's they have commercial.
No, that's true.
Well, where else are you going to learn something like that except in a commercial publisher? Unless you're actually dealing with a printer, you wouldn't learn it.
That's right. But you'd think as much printing as there is. Now, you take Stauder. This book I've got in here, Larry Edwards, he sent this to a printer, and there was nobody to work on it like that. And it looks like some country newspaper.
Otherwise, you have plenty of jobs for somebody who wants to do that, if anybody wants to do it. Because they all want somebody.
I see. Mm-hmm. Time Hill Press. Yeah. Yeah, it does.
It looks like it's just the manuscript and they just printed it solid.
It sure does.
With a few breaks.
Margins are too small.
Print's too big, don't you think? Or too close together or something?
The margins are too small. I think that's part of it. Oh, yeah, you're not supposed to have a title page on the... Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this should be a separate title page with a copyright page on the... Oh, there is, but that's... No, this is all... This is not right.
Well, there has to be, you know, there is a taste as well as convention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is... Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a big type. I mean, it's a typeface that comes out big. But it's just like those two lines shouldn't be there. That's just
okay. Right, that's like a new chapter because I've just started it there.
Oh, no. Here it is. Here's the way I wrote about it to send as a Christmas greeting to my friends, Christmas on the Hill. But that should be in different type or this.
Well, but then it just runs into the text again.
Well, you could do something with space.
Yeah,
see, if you're going to have it in different type, that's okay. You could have it in different type, but you shouldn't have it in the same type.
You could have it in italics or something.
Something like that. See, it's in all the same, well, no, it's a little smaller than that. But it looks like it's a subtitle. It's a little smaller than this subtitle. That's the size is so smaller.
Yeah.
But it looks, that. And it's too prominent.
Yeah.
It should be.
Well, that's what the printer did.
Yeah, that's what the printer did. He didn't know any better. No?
Mm-hmm. And look how far it goes, just solid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that shouldn't be. There are no chapters. It looks like.
No.
There ought to be some chapters or some breaks. Because this is just, like you say, it's like a country newspaper. Oh my goodness. So, I see. He starts off with a little explanation of what he's writing about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is something he wrote years ago and stuck
mm-hmm.
in.
Mm-hmm. This thing, that's not good. That's open.
Well, now that's what you can't find. Now, if I want to publish something at Scotus, that's the best printer here.
Mm-hmm.
It would come out looking like that. Unless he just marked it up to correspond to the Florida Press. And that has some little taste. And
mm-hmm.
and the you know that book you had, the one on Melville.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done with some little taste, just barest amount of taste.
Yeah, like these are really boring heads. Just
yeah.
to have things all capitals all across the line. You can do something so much more attractive than that.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to have it artistic or arty.
They're just simple
to
little
make it different.
Things.
It looks like the same. It's the
it
same
is.
Typeface.
It is
the
same typeface.
It's a different typeface or bold or something.
Mm-hmm.
Italic.
Well, now you see, I don't know a soul in Gainesville to do that. The lady that works in Debbie's office is an old hand at it, but she her husband, both of them work for the Florida Press, isn't it? But you see, she's got all she wants to do. She don't want to put in her nights doing that.
Do you know when you know?
I don't know how to mark something up for a printer, not a book.
Could she tell
you? Yeah, she could, I guess. If because we always at Tufts we printed offsets and just gave them camera ready.
Uh huh.
So we didn't do anything.
Yeah.
they talk about offset, but it's sort of ambiguous. They talk about for one thing, you can have a typescript that's offset, or you can have a regular printing type set.
Mm-hmm.
Set the type and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose all printing is offset in that sense, photographic.
Well, the last stage of everything is, but the first stage, the proofs are usually done in hot metal.
Yeah.
In monotype, unless they're done by computer, and there is some computer typesetting. It's so awful, though. I really don't like it. Yeah, computers, they're very simple, and they can only do a few things, and they make a lot of mistakes. So.
They do a lot of newspapers by computer now.
Well, they do a lot of books by computer, but it's...
They even the set of type, they'll still photograph it.
Mm-hmm.
And the product as it comes out will be photographic.
Ultimately, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the last stage you get before something is a book is clues.
Yeah. So if you have a typescript, you don't justify your margins, and it's just like a little school magazine. And
mm-hmm.
it ought to look like a book if you're going to print a book.
I think it should look like a book. In fact, I not only think it should look like a book, I've developed very definite ideas about what a good book, a well-designed, well-produced book should look like.
Yeah.
About the margins and the heads and the footnotes and where they should be and how they should be numbered and things like that.
Well, now, you don't need a good typescript. If I turn in something like this, I don't have to have it. Just rough typing is good as any of it.
Sure.
So it's correct. You
sure.
You want to proof it.
No, you edit the manuscript for mistakes.
Sure.
But you don't have to give the printer a perfect manuscript. I mean, you can give
you
the printer
don't.
A manuscript with red marks on it and directions and words written in.
Yeah.
See, the printer prints it all up.
Yeah.
And then
well, if I go through that stage of expert typing.
Well, it helps the printer. It's easier for the printer. if the manuscript doesn't have a lot of mistakes on it. Because when you get a manuscript with a lot of mistakes...
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a legible manuscript,
mm-hmm.
as one that's visible. See, I don't know anyone who turned out one any other way.
No, I've seen some that look like, I don't know, look like the whole Russian army walked across it.
Oh, yeah, I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
I'm talking about just
a decently...
decent manuscript, but
mm-hmm.
not one like electric.
Oh, no, it doesn't have to be like
a typewriter.
Or not like a dissertation.
No, because, the manuscript doesn't have to be perfect
mm-hmm.
by any means.
Well,
not like this with the syllable can't go over the inch margin. Really?
Oh, not really. We just say they're supposed to have, we specify the margins, and they think that they have to abide by those as if it were the gospel truth. And they want them to look, to be a good copy because it's going to be bound that way. But they can certainly go into the margin. Just, they trim the pages when they bind
mm-hmm.
by a quarter of an inch, so they can't run to the edge of the page or they'll cut off the text.
Mm-hmm.
And I just tell them that. I tell them they can certainly run a word into the margin.
What is this paper? Did you bring me a sample?
Mm-hmm. Certainly did. Don't get out. It's right over here.
I brought you the first two pages.
Well, you can give me a Xerox when you get home.
It's not, that just tells what the main case is about.
Yeah. Now, you have to use this form?
Yeah, well, he said we could use that form, which is the less formal form,
yeah.
or the law review form.
That's a waste of effort. Why don't you just go ahead and type it and read it? I'm not
going to
print it, publish it.
Well, I am just typing it. That's just typing.
Well, it is.
That's not anything.
Space and footnotes. You can put the footnotes at the back.
No, he said we couldn't put the footnotes.
I said
besides, there are only two footnotes in the whole paper, and that's one of them. Everything else is cited where it comes, you know, in little parentheses. That's why it's not the formal form.
Oh, you get to do that? You can mix them up like that?
That's what I like about legal writing. You don't have to use footnotes unless you're doing the law review style. When you do the law review style, then your footnotes are longer than your text.
I'm not talking about the law review style. I'm talking about just the class paper.
Mm-hmm.
That all that wasted spacing.
What wasted space?
Well, double space.
But it's easier to read double space.
The hell it is.
Of course it is.
Why, it just makes me sick. I just don't put up with this old double space stuff.
Let me see that. Looks pretty from here.
It's all right. Now tell me, what is this now about your point in this?
My point in that?
In your paper, yeah.
Well, I tell you, it's
Supreme
not.
Court.
Yeah, the Supreme Court, you see, decided this case about Mr. Alexander and the Gardner-Denver Company.
Yeah.
And they decided that Mr. Alexander claimed that he was demoted,
yeah.
discharged. I'm sorry, he was discharged because he was black and he was discriminated against, and that was why he was discharged. The company said he was discharged because he produced too many defective parts with his drill.
So they arbitrated.
They arbitrated it. The arbitrator said he was discharged for just cause. He went to the EEOC. The EEOC said there was no good reason to believe that he had been discriminated against. Well, but they told him that he had a right to file suit in federal court. This was before it was arbitrated.
That's it.
That's
Supreme Court.
Federal court. U.S. District Court. Because most labor cases go into the federal courts. They're covered by federal law. He filed a suit in the federal court, and the district court said that because the case had gone through arbitration and the arbitrator had decided against him, that he couldn't bring a suit. It was all over with the arbitrator. The Court of Appeals for the, I think it's the 9th or 10th Circuit, I forget, said it agreed with the district court. And he went again to the Supreme Court, And the Supreme Court said, no, he did have a right to bring the suit. And that's all the Supreme Court says in this case, is that you can bring a suit even though you've had an adverse arbitration hearing. Well, this means that no arbitration of any problem that involves fair employment and discrimination is final, that it can always be brought up again. And this is creates some problems for arbitration, because the thing that makes arbitration useful for labor problems is that it's final, so that you can, and it's easy and it's quick, so that once something has gone through, that's it. Well, this is I think going to be troublesome for.
So what you're trying to figure out is why the court did it.
Yeah, now the first part is the background, and I go into some of the cases from the lower courts on both sides. And then I go into what the court said it was doing, because it gave a 20-page opinion. And he goes through it almost like a poem. You know, you pick out this reasoning and that reasoning, and I look at the authorities it used and how it felt about these problems. And at the end, that's the middle part. Then in the last part, I looked at all the cases that had come down after this case that had cited this case's authority, and what the results seemed to be, how the case was being used. And I also found an NLRB decision of a couple of months ago that's directly opposite to this case. It seems to be conflicting with the Supreme Court, and I just put that in to show that not everybody thought this was such a good idea, this case.
But now, you said the Supreme Court was a little doubtful about the informality.
Yeah, the Supreme Court, I think, because they're all lawyers and judges, they think if something isn't decided before a bunch of judges, with people wearing black robes and people being cross-examined and taking oaths and strict rules of evidence, that it's not good enough.
Well, she's still a civilian at heart.
Oh, yeah. I don't much like the courts, I must say. That's why I like labor.
Well, now, you put the two together, you see. Debbie's in a rough spot over there. I knew that when she started, you see, and that she was in the meanest section of the whole university. If I could pick out a rougher spot to get the full contamination on short notice, she picked it out. And I told you that. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
No.
I mean, whether I told her or not. Well, now you see what she's going to do. Well, of the two of you, you pick the easy way out. Once you get a profession, you see, you still have a little choice, but you're tied down. And anything, I don't know of anything that decides your future quicker than that, except settling down, getting married, settling down, having 6 or 8 children.
Right in a row.
Yeah, and then you've got no
no, that's it.
No more choices.
There's hardly
no
any.
No more decisions.
No chance of that.
What's on? We could both be a whole lot worse off.
We could be married.
Each of us could have 3 or 4 by now.
Yeah.
Good.
In all
stages,
you know. That's right.
And that's screaming. Yeah.
But now, the thing is, I try to see is that this somehow or other doesn't quite tally with your with any of your old background, except that you repudiated your background long ago.
Yeah. Well, yes.
You still speak
so.
To your friends.
Oh, yes. I go down there. I go down there a couple of times a year.
Yeah.
And
you take your knitting with you?
I don't knit.
In a manner of speaking. Your con law book.
That's true. I don't do that in the summer. No. No, I thought I was going to have to take a project this summer when I went down there, but I finished.
You see, you think of your grandmother's an old pill.
I do not. Well, in a way, I do. But I love her.
You don't like outsiders, you say.
Well, she doesn't like for people to come in and disrupt the family. She's afraid that somebody will, and of course.
I haven't seen any family to disrupt. I'm just feeding you. I'm just feeding you a little fill-up, so.
Well, there are 200 of her close relatives in South Mississippi.
What?
And she, 200.
That's why they're all going to the camp meeting.
That camp meeting has 200 people.
And they're her relatives.
Yeah, mine too.
Well, you could slip Debbie in with a little mustache and she'd never know. She'd think she is 200.
I got brown eyes, Russell. Does that make me a noblesse?
No, because they're all Felders and they all have red hair and blue eyes.
Oh, like your sister Faye.
Like my sister Faye.
Oh.
You have a sister Faye.
Mm-hmm.
Red hair. And it's an F-A-Y-E, too, isn't it?
No, it's,
oh, it's an
F-A-Y.
F-A-Y. Oh.
But she has red hair and green eyes. And she looks like great-great-aunt Julia. Well, she has red hair like great-great-aunt Julia. And my great-aunt Doris. And...
Why?
Oh, you like the legal side of the great-aunts, and you like to get the hierarchy.
Yeah, I always wanted to know who was where.
Yeah.
You know, how, because I was running around with all these kids when I was little and would go out there and would want to know how they were related to me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's that. Pauline knows all that.
Yeah.
Well, you have a sister who's a lawyer.
Right, Faye is a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But she is deciding.
She certifies hospitals. And nursing homes for state funds. Well, you know what she does, though. She travels around to all these little towns in Mississippi, Moss Point and so forth, and holds public hearings.
So you'd think she'd be well acquainted with the little towns in Mississippi.
She will be before she's through, I think.
Well, that's highly doubtful, according to our study of Mr. Nealon.
Really?
Yeah, the county agent mentality. Part of it. What they do, they know everybody in the county, but when they talk to them, they're pushing a program. So they don't really see much of the person. We work that out.
Mm-hmm.
That also applies to, well, it wouldn't apply to lawyers.
No, I see what you mean, that her job removes her from people.
Yes. I tried, I wanted to find somebody who was acquainted with the old rednecks, the old farmers who check us. And, of course, there are people who do that, but I haven't had somehow or other.
You can give it to me back?
No.
I've got to have it.
How did you get brought it to me?
It's her paper.
It's my paper.
Well, it's not doing me any good. I was just looking at it.
I have to take it back to New York with me. Maybe
you
have to Xerox it.
You remember what you got down
I'll
there.
I'll make a Xerox of it tomorrow.
Yeah, but I can't just sit down and tell good old Marshall Lippman.
Just
of course, he knows this as well as I do. That's what the waste of it is.
Yeah, do the whole paper, and then we'll study it. I wanted to know about sharecroppers, and I ran across old Gorman Etheridge, and he had liquidated some of the sharecroppers when they found out who was going to work out and who wasn't. And I pressed him, and he never did quite settle down for it. He just told me that's what he did. He said, well, he looked at it to see what the programs were. If they had cotton and followed it with corn and rotated.
Hmm.
That's all I ever got out of him. He didn't know one dead burn sharecropper. But he was a character, Gorman himself. Nothing to do with sharecroppers. I lost track of him. He did. He had cancer. They had the funeral before Christmas. Died in January.
Had the funeral first?
He wanted to be at the funeral.
Yeah.
He's set at this table. He's peg legs.
He had the funeral before he died. He knew he was going to die and he had the funeral first? With the sermon and everything?
He wanted to be there and see what it said. I guess.
That's the most amazing thing.
Now you find curious things.
Did he pick the hymn?
I wasn't there. And the man who, his good friend, didn't want to talk about it. And I got it second or third or fourth hand. So I'd have to make it up if I told you. I told you what hymns he had. Oh, you know he had a hymn.
Oh, yeah.
That was his background. He was from Chiefland. I used to sit down there and drink coffee with him. He'd talk to the troopers, patrolmen.
State troopers.
That's more than I've been able to do for a generation. Now this little thing of Debbie's, that's the nicest thing we've done. Now, she wrote it. It's her story and all like that, but it won't speak for itself. It's not that far along. It's promising. It's interesting. It's worth getting into. But now, you see, she did that one fall when she came, and then the next fall we were discontinuing. And trying to get something to show for our efforts, and that's what we worked on. And I thought about all the trouble would be with Debbie could type it up and space it out, and I'd look at it and write a little something for her. And when I got into it, I had all the notes. I knew when she wrote everything, and she had talked about a lot of them in here. We had them on tape before she wrote them. All sorts of things. But what I found was, I actually didn't know anything about them. And it didn't take me long to find out. For instance, I'd read one of them, and I'd say to myself, what did she say? And I didn't know. And it was a curious thing that happened. the key to it, this was actually the key to it for me, was that little piece of CZ. And that's the flimsiest one of the whole thing. But as it turned out, autobiographically, it's right interesting. You see, that Christmas before she went off on the trip, they'd all come out here and they'd gone down and get oranges one thing and came back and were sitting here. And for the first time, I got into this culture of laughter. I mean, it was healthy, hearty, full laughter. All of them were doing it, you see. Katie and your godmother, and of course Debbie, she was right up there amongst her elders. They would talk about things and laugh. And I had some little contact with laughter. Wade laughed. And I saw a number of times even then that he would do better reporting if he wouldn't laugh so much. That laughter sort of cuts out some of the things he could say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I thought in this, but I never said it in the manuscript because it wouldn't be tactful, and I didn't need to say it. I didn't need to say it. But what it was, it helped me, it showed me, it gave me the sort of the start to, you see, we wrote back and forth all the time she was over there. And I was quarreling with it all the time. For instance, she didn't take a typewriter, so she sent back a little bitty old note, you see, that she wrote
that blue,
on her knee.
That blue stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All nice, but not very substantial. In other words, she wasn't doing anything that she could have learned from me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was regretting it, except I never could say it, you see, because she'd stop writing.
Now you know.
See, the way it turned out, at this Assisi place, they were at this old cold hotel, and there's only one, they had paint buckets they had to walk over, and there's just one other person in the dining room, and that's this woman who they thought was listening to them, but didn't, and when they found out about it, you know, it turned that over that tickle box. And they went to the room and laughed, you see, just foolish laughter. But then I could see Debbie was learning to laugh from them. And then by extension, what she sees through them. And actually, for traveling, especially in France, she was much better off following them than she would have been following me, because I was in France, and I was about the sorriest traveler in France. You see, I couldn't even drink wine. It made me give me the GI.
He could speak all right, but he couldn't drink wine.
Okay. That was my springboard. Then after that, it was really easy. Then you take the little one you see about the fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that take the guidebook. It's a harebrained idea, you see, that she gets, she learns from the guidebook how to look at pictures. But she knows guidebooks. And then she brings in that sort of pseudo-reference to Hugo that she's never read. But anyhow, you'll allow her that you see. but see, the guidebook works because it gets her into the paintings, Giotto and I don't know who it is, the Florentine people, and she could see that the great Renaissance people weren't all holy. They weren't the big cheese, the whole cheese. You had all those painters of the virgins back in there. Earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the guidebook.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it works. You see, it gets her into it. Well, now the fashions is much more interesting. Here's a little boy She doesn't do this through method. See, her method is not taking her through this.
Mm-hmm.
It's instinct. I don't know what it is. It's her parents. It's those people she's traveling with that did it.
Mm-hmm.
Just the culture. You see, I don't know what did it. The little boy, you see, tries on those clothes and goes in there and lets Debbie look him over.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's beautiful. It's one of the most charming little pictures, you see, of family life I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything. I never saw anything like that. That's right in the heart of the family, you see, even before breakfast. you couldn't quite get any more private unless you go to the bedroom or something like that. See, you don't want to be bothered. And, all right, you think you're in for fashions, French fashions, but you're not. Because the fashions go into skiing, and into eating, and into working in the garden, and the yachting, and the finest one is at the end where they dress up to go to a wedding. But it's not the dressing up that you're interested in, the process, you're interested in the wedding. So
mm-hmm.
You see, it goes into what this little thing I learned from just reading a few pages of Eudora Welty. It's the occasion. You see that all of them knew how to live and
mm-hmm.
also to create. They created one right here at this table. And it was rich. I came in and put a damper on it because I couldn't respond to it. I hadn't the faintest idea. It took me 6 months to catch on to things. Well, now that's where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now it's the process. Now, here's this little girl. She's just arriving. She dropped her suitcase in the grass. I ran to the backyard and jumped up with two of the boys on the bouncer. I don't know what this thing is. I call it a bouncer. In between Roy and Little Battle, she jumped, and the delights of anticipation seemed to shake her up and down. She remembered, as one remembers first the eyes of a loved person, the old blue water cooler on the back porch. As she bounces, she remembers that. She's just getting home. How thirsty she always was when she's standing there. Among the round and square wooden tables, always piled with snap beans, turnip greens, onions from Bayship to Greenwood. And while you drank, your eyes were on this green place here in the backyard, is on the joggling board, on the neglected greenhouse, on Aunt Ellen's guineas in the old buggy, on the stable wall, elbow deep in the vine. Now you see how rich it is? Now that, you see, is what this sort of thing enabled me to see that.
Oh.
And that's the gift that Debbie has. Well, now there's a good bit more to it. And I never saw anyone identify that. I did it right here, working with Slim. And it's one of the insights in this little production. And what that the whole thing is, you see, for the sketches, it's the same thing for Debbie. In this last part, I'm working with them, you see. I don't work by myself in this. It's just a series of insights.
Mm-hmm.
And insights that I've never seen before. You just get into it and just wait for something to happen. Now, just one other thing. Now, you see, they had the instinct. Now, this comes out, and this is what you do. Now, actually, I worked backwards on this. We had already learned this that February. Well, that was. See, she wrote this, and then we worked on Mr. Weaver. And it was while we were working on the hunting story of Mr. Weaver that I saw the hunting hunts and the dogs as a way of ending the culture. So that enabled me to use that, you see, but I go from Mr. Weaver and the countryside to the French to see that all these things she talks about are ways of entering the culture. I never thought of that before. It just came out. And if I had known that, you see, back 20 or 30 years ago, look how much I could have used it. I had no idea. I went to the Gothic places, and what did I do? I just looked at the Gothic and thought about the Middle Ages. Well, what the hell did I lose in the Middle Ages? What I want to do is look at France through the Gothic, and through the food, through the clothes and all like that. Well, I did just to a very small extent, but if I had really realized what I was doing, you see, I could have wrote a book then.
Mm-hmm.
I could have wrote several books then.
See, he was too intellectual.
Oh,
yeah.
I wasn't. I was just stuffy. Well, now that's, you see, now that's, now here's the other thing about the countryside. Mr. Weaver was over here, and he was feeling awful bad. He's nervous, and when he's nervous, he runs off the mouth, and he talks and makes himself more nervous. And I said to him out there, we were walking right there with Patsy. I said, Mr. Weaver, why don't you keep your damn mouth shut? You're wearing yourself out. And he looked at me, and he said, you know, sometimes I feel if I can't talk, I'll die. Now, that's an extreme case of that urge for reporting, which this honorable culture that she lives in doesn't have. Mine doesn't either. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not throwing off on anybody. And all these universities don't have it. All these enormous writing schools and writing programs, you see, they produce such a pitifully small amount. And what they produce is... Well, they're gifted, and they're good critics, and they learn a great deal, you see. They can use a large term.
Mm-hmm.
They do that marvelously well, but they can't write. They can't report on experience. For one thing, they don't have much experience to report on. Well, now you see how it works out.
Mm-hmm.
Now you say, you just cut out all that part I did at the end there, but you see, I didn't do all that. You see, all this, what we call about travel, actually, you see, her fascination for the language, because it enables her to travel, actually, it's to travel, it means to have the experience. And we make statements about that is the immunity you feel over there. They allow you an immunity as strangers, and in return you allow them immunity. And one of the fine cases you see is that, well, it's not one of the best pieces, but it certainly makes it clear that English breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And that English breakfast, Faye is, that's one of the most charming things Faye ever got into, you see. She had breakfast with a Mrs. Tarbell, not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been doing that all their life, and their breakfast was never the same, and they were always interesting. We stayed there a week or two.
Mm.
All in exquisite taste.
Mm.
Nothing coarse about it. I mean, it was rich. Well, you see, she gets into things like that. It's amazing. And she has an appreciation for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, that's so much for that. But now, here's the thing. I don't think the book has had a fair reading. No one along the line. Well, there are one or two errors, but I don't think that really accounts for it. At the end, you see, where somebody said on this page they can't tell who the I is. Well, changes from me to Debbie because there's a solid quote of some of the some sketch of hers, and somehow or another we didn't block it off mm-hmm. to where you could see that. Well, that's a fair amount of thing. All you got to do is retype it with margin, retype it, and it's because I know as much as I've done, I'm not going to confuse the eyes.
No.
I don't think it's had a fair reading, a good reading.
Mm-mm.
I think her peers and elders have fallen down on that. I think they've let her down. They don't bother me. And that's the reason she's still at that desk, I'd say. You do something that's really interesting and get no acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
But
not good.
Now here's the other side of it. You see, she knows what's in it, and she knows what she can do.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, somebody, see, has to exercise his own judgment and start writing his own reviews.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Whitman did.
I like your own work, Betty.
Now, that takes a pretty hearty constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I'd do it. I might not get away with it.
We've got a station break. 7:30.
Oh, we have to go. Oh.
7:30?
No,
we've
got
7:30.
Your watch is stopped.
Oh, we covered everything.
Just about. That's pretty.
I don't know why you don't feel as if you've got a halo on. you and your daughter Welk in the same sentence.
I tell you what, you say this doesn't have much substance, and it wouldn't, you see, of course, you judge it by Article 7.
Title 7.
Title 7. It wouldn't have much substance. But when I read that, I've not always been able to do that. And it's not my nature. That's not my genius. That's not my gift. But when I see that, there's a richness about it that just makes that other stuff just seem sort of watery.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, when you do it naturally, she's not trying to do that. She don't bone up on it. Now, I've done it, but it took me half a day to write a paragraph because I had to go out there in the tool shed and look at all the tools and come back and set them down. Then I'd forget which one was. I have to go back up. Proctor has to do a chart, you see. Debbie can walk in a room and have a dozen people in there she's never seen before. First thing you know, she knows their grandchildren or grandparents or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she don't try.
Mm-mm.
Well.
Mm-mm. No, she just sits there and they
all come.
And it's open to them and they all come and...
I suppose she can contribute something to dissertation to those.
Oh, stop it.
You can't say you hadn't tried.
Thank you.
Well, everybody has to have
Well, I'm sorry. What happened to your time?
Oh, we're in plenty of time. That's fine. You know, I knew that you had it turned the other way so that we couldn't look at it.
You had it turned around so that we couldn't look at it. You're awful, Guy Miles. You just, no trust in you. We'll see you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Russell Noble, and Debbie with Faye. This Thursday at supper, the 23rd of January, 75, Channel 1 over, around at the end of Channel 1 over, around 1600, Channel 1 over around 1600, and this is the end of the visit with Russell Nobles and Debbie. This Thursday at supper, the 23rd of January, 75, Channel 1 over, around 1600, the end of the visit with Russell Nobles and Debbie this Thursday at supper, the 23rd of January, 75.